Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Both the House and Senate Education Committees are racing to address the spending thresholds of Act 46, the state's new school district consolidation law. In his State of the State address, Governor Peter Shumlin said the caps are harming education in Vermont, and he urged lawmakers to get rid of them.
The rigid spending caps that were a teeny part of the bill, I believe, has become the enemy of the good. I ask you to work swiftly in the coming weeks to pass either a moratorium or a repeal of this small piece of Act 46 before school boards have to send their budgets to the printers prior to town meeting. Let's get that done together.
What's the future for these spending thresholds, and will lawmakers act to change the law before local school boards finalize their budgets for next year? With us today to discuss these issues are Senate Education Chairwoman Ann Cummings and House Education Chairman David Sharp. Thanks for being on the program. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Let's take a stab at reviewing how the spending thresholds work. Let me run through it, and then Representative Sharp, you can evaluate my performance. It's a variable cap, so towns with high per pupil spending are allowed to increase their spending by roughly 1% before penalties are imposed. Towns in the middle on spending would face roughly 2% increase before hitting the penalty threshold. And low-spending towns would be allowed to raise their per-pupil spending by about 3 to 4% before they'd face any penalties, and the spending thresholds would be in place for a two-year period. Does that cover it pretty well?
That's close. There are outliers on both ends. There are school districts that have 0% growth, and there are school districts that have as much as 5.5% because of their low spending.
So the House and the Senate gave their approval to this legislation last May. The governor signed it into law. Representative Sharp, at that time, you probably had a pretty good sense of what kind of impact it was going to have. So why is there a discussion now that these caps either need to be adjusted or perhaps eliminated?
So we started hearing concerns about school districts staying under these spending limits fairly soon after the bill was passed. That continued during the summer. And so we had actually had a committee meeting in the fall, in November, to hear both in terms of what good things were happening under Act 46, and there have been numerous really good things happening under Act 46, and then also some of the detrimental effects of the high spending thresholds. And the thing we heard the most was concern about an unexpected 7.9% increase in healthcare premiums. So there was, at that time, there was consensus, I'd say, on our committee that doing some softening or tweaking of the caps was what we would consider. We felt strongly that they were doing their job with regard to keeping down costs per pupil expenses across the state, and we did not want to abandon them. But we're adults, and we can listen to the concerns and do something about it. So that's where the proposal to increase the thresholds 0.9% for every school district across the state came from.
So next Tuesday on the House floor, this bill is going to be up for debate. Is it your feeling, by giving local school boards a little more wiggle room, that these expanded caps will still do their job?
Yes.
And why is that?
Because we hear that school boards are paying attention to these thresholds across the state, that many school districts are working hard, that have worked hard to get underneath the thresholds, roughly 150 school districts. And we've heard that there's roughly 127 school districts that may not be able to stay under the thresholds.
Senator Cummings, you voted for this bill last year. What do you know now about these spending thresholds that perhaps you didn't know back then that causes you to want to support a total repeal?
Okay. This proposal came on the last day of the Committee of Conference, and we heard and saw a printout that was pretty much what you've heard. It sounded like it would do what we wanted. It would, you know, it would tighten up thresholds on high spenders and give the low spenders some more leeway. We started Act 46 because there was a concern that especially in poorer, low-spending towns, they were not able to do the same educational opportunity that larger, higher-spending towns were. And so there wasn't really a desire to withhold funding at that level. That what we know now is that low-spending towns are being impacted, and that some who have a fund balance are able to get by spending down their fund balance, but others are going to have to make cuts in educational offering, which is not what we want them to do. So I think the Senate is saying, you know, we tried, we understand, we need to find a way to control the rise in property tax. We tried. This is not doing what we intended it to do. And so we need to step back and continue to work to find a way that will solve the problem without negatively impacting the education of our children in very basic math, reading kinds of ways. And normally, we would do that on a bill. We have to move quickly this time because school budgets are in process, and if we don't want those cuts to be made, then we have to find a way to allow the schools to continue.
You know, I've heard Representative Sharp say several times that these spending thresholds are needed to sort of right-size schools in Vermont. He points to the fact that over the last 10 years, the state has lost about 15% of its student enrollment. Yeah. He doesn't see a corresponding reduction in professional and paraprofessional positions. And he says, you know, something's got to be done about that. Is he right?
That's what we discovered when we did Act 46. We started because the cost of education is not going down at anywhere near the rate that the student enrollment is going down. Well, the first things we found was that we are supporting an awful lot of very small schools in a very inefficient manner. We have fixed cost, and the fixed cost for a school is the same if you've got a 50 or 100 kids in it. And so we said, look, you need to talk. You need to find a way to reform your governance system. You don't necessarily have to control, you know, close schools, but you have to figure out on your own what is the most economically efficient way to deliver a good education to students. The response to that has been much larger and much better than we anticipated. And schools that we never thought would talk are talking. The caps are getting in the way of that. That's where the focus is going. And it's not just thresholds. There is a significant tax penalty. Most of the schools we're looking at are looking at 2 to 5 cents increase in their local taxes. And in low income towns that are spending very frugally, that's unacceptable. So the schools have to make the cuts into their educational program.
Today in the program, we're looking at the spending thresholds of Act 46. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Do you think that they'll help contain education costs? Are they hurting the quality of education? Should they be changed in any way? Perhaps repealed? Or should they be left in place for a 2-year period? 1-800-639-2211 is our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation. Representative Sharp, you know, we've discussed two options here today. The House that wants to increase the caps by 0.9%. The Senate would like to repeal the caps altogether, but some lawmakers are actually talking about a third option, and that is don't do anything at all. Let the caps go into place with no changes. And House Minority Leader Don Turner favors this approach.
This is the law of Vermont today. I don't know why people think there's chaos, because there isn't. The law is black and white. They know what they have to do. Many school boards have done it, and I wish that everyone would do it. And I think that it's a great disservice to those boards that have worked really hard to achieve the goals that were laid out in Act 46 if we change it.
So, Representative Sharp, you've got a certain number of House members who say, don't touch this thing at all. What would you say to them?
I would say that we can listen to what the real concerns of school board members and superintendents are across the state, who are working very hard to stay under these thresholds, but finding it impossible because of some extraordinary costs. And I think listening is a good idea. And if we can keep the concepts behind the thresholds of keeping cost containment while modifying them slightly, I think that's the pathway to go.
Senator Cummings, we got this email from Paul, who lives in Hinesburg. Paul wrote us, I served on a local school board for 6 years and was routinely frustrated by the inability of the legislature to make a decision and stick with it. My local colleagues and I would take each new legislative mandate very seriously and get to work to prepare a budget that met the new criteria. Then we'd be surprised and disappointed when the legislature would succumb to the outcry from non-compliant school boards late in the budget season. As a former board member, I know that penalties and incentives work. As a taxpayer, I expect my legislators to make difficult decisions and stick with them. What would you say to Paul?
I would say to Paul that Act 46 was a major change, the first major change in school government since, I think, 1840. We knew when we did it that we would have to make adjustments. The thresholds, the Senate had for 5 hours. I would say that we should learn not to make, I routinely won't vote for amendments on the floor that haven't been vetted by a committee just for this reason, that you get to the end of the session and, you know, there's a lot of pressure to go home and also a lot of pressure to start Act 46, because we do understand that that taxpayers are struggling, and that has a lot of economic reasons. But I think to just say that's fine, schools vary widely. And my primary concern is the education of all children in Vermont. And to say that children in larger schools that have larger budgets, that have more programs, you know, that are elective, can, you know, that they can meet the thresholds, and that other children have to have their math and science offerings cut, is not equitable. And I think, you know, we aren't perfect. We have very limited staff, and we do the best we can. But I think, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for school boards. They're in the same position. And I think by working together, we will find a way out of this.
I'd like to push back just a little bit on this notion that it was done in haste in the last minute. So the House considered these for a number of weeks. And in fact, we had caps in an earlier version of the bill, and those caps would have said if you spent $1 more than what the cap is, your budget was deemed to have failed, and you had to go back to the voters with a budget that stayed within the caps. So this version of what was eventually passed did come later on, but it was a version of a effort at cost containment that had been talked about for a number of weeks.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Mark, who's in Berkshire. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. As a Vermont taxpayer, I got to say that over the past 15 years, my taxes have, for education alone, have quadrupled. Now, my income hasn't gone up by 300%, My cost of living hasn't gone down by 300%. I want to know how the education system can justify a 300% increase in my taxes, a lowering of the number of students that are going in, not letting any positions go with the teachers, and just this is an unsustainable pattern. You can't keep jacking taxes up this high for this long and expect people to keep paying. And then to hear that the teachers are going to have a 7% increase in their health care and they're upset about it, think the taxpayers ought to pick that up? No. Our health care is going up as well. This is going to stop. You have to find a way to fund these schools not out of the taxpayers' pockets this heavily.
Okay, Mark, thanks very much for your phone call, Representative Sharp. Are the caps and the thresholds and the penalties designed in part to help contain costs and try to keep spending down?
So I think the caller makes some really good points. And it's some of the things that I heard when I was knocking on doors as I campaigned last cycle. And the Act 46 actually deals with this in two ways. One is saying we need to rearrange how we operate our schools so that we can deliver better education for less money. So we actually, in fact, need to deliver better opportunities to some students than we currently do. And we need to do it within a cost structure that taxpayers can afford. This two-year threshold that was put in Act 46 was designed partly as a bridge from where we are now, where our schools are pretty expensive on a per-pupil basis, to a system, a governance system, and a way of running our schools that's more efficient and can cost less per pupil.
Today in the program, we're looking at the spending thresholds of Act 46. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to see if there's a compromise brewing between the House and the Senate on this issue. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, we're looking at the spending thresholds of Act 46. Our guests, House Education Chairman David Sharp and Senate Education Chairwoman Ann Cummings. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. So let's get a sense of where we are right now. Next Tuesday, the House is going to take up the idea of giving school boards a little more wiggle room, the 0.9% added to their spending threshold. The Senate, that same day, and probably at exactly the same time, is going to take up a bill to repeal these spending thresholds altogether. Normally, after final approval in both chambers, we'll have a conference committee set up to try to work out a compromise. Time is really of the essence here. Representative Sharp, how optimistic are you that somehow there will be a compromise reached before this bill goes to conference?
How confident am I? I don't know. So some days I feel very confident. Other days I worry that nothing will get done. And I think that's the worst thing for Vermonters, dithering and not finding a conclusion. Is always problematic, and it leaves school boards and voters trying to figure out where to go from here. So I'm working very hard, and I believe the Senate is, and others, to try to find a way, path forward in this.
So how do you convince the Senate? The Senate is probably going to vote to repeal. It seems like the votes are there in the Senate to repeal. How do you convince them that there's yet another option that they should consider, and what might it be?
Well, I would think from the Senate's perspective, and Senator Cummings probably should answer this better than I, but that doing nothing is not an answer that they'd be happy with.
So the option of doing nothing at all, basically you're saying if there's a stalemate on this, then the law just stays in place and nothing happens at all. So do you have some thoughts about how you might frame a compromise?
Yeah, I think that there are some opportunities to find a way forward, fashioning the threshold differently, or I'm not sure. I don't have an answer today. I'd give it to you if I had one, but I don't have one. But I think that there are some opportunities.
And Senator Cummings, if the Senate's going to vote for repeal, what would you be looking for in a compromise?
I think a compromise that I'd be looking for is one that did not impact the low spending towns, the towns that have done everything we've asked them to do, and does not negatively impact the educational quality of students. And I think we need to keep focused on that. When our state colleges are telling us that a large number of the, we have one of the lowest continuation rates into any kind of post-secondary education in the country. And the students we're sending to the state colleges are coming needing remedial work at a time when employers are saying they can't get students out of high school that have the math skills they need to take today's manufacturing jobs, that to be taking action that further restricts the educational opportunities that students in smaller, poorer towns receive, to me, is counterproductive. I don't have a problem saying, you know, you've got to hold it very tight on the high end, but there's a wide variation in spending, in schools, in school governance, in school structure in this state. But the end product is we have to have an educated workforce, or the economy in this state will be worse than it presently is.
How much of an incentive is it to you to reach a compromise? As Representative Sharp said, you know, if you don't come to an agreement, current law stays in place and these thresholds are going to be in place for the next 2 years. Is that a pretty big incentive for you to try to reach a compromise with the House?
Anyone that's worked with me in the Senate knows that my, on any issue, I try and find common ground at all possible. And I think Representative Sharp and I have a good working relationship. We have good committees, and I think we're all working as hard and fast as we can.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Dan in Newfane. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, you know, I think in this discussion, there are two major cost drivers for schools, which no one seems to want to mention. And the first one, of course, is the rising cost of health care. And when Governor Shulman came into office, you know, he's going to fix how we're going to have universal health care. Well, when that got abandoned, those costs are still every year going to the school. So a school can hold its budget to, you know, 0% increase, and yet the increase in health care premiums alone at whatever they are, from 7 to 15%, you know, varying from the year and from the companies, that alone is enough to put some of these schools over that threshold. And the other driver, which is also has nothing to do with education, is the fact that I've taught part-time at Leland and Gray High School in Windham County for 15, 16 years. And over the years, this situation has only gotten worse, and that is we have a very large population of students who come to school unprepared to learn. They come to school hungry. They come to school with a rotten tooth and toothache, mental health issues, physical health issues, broken home issues. And the school, naturally and rightly, deals with those problems as best they can. You know, our school has looked elsewhere for funding so they can find dental care for kids. We have a robust counseling organ, you know, bunch of counselors at the school and mental health workers. Every dollar that is spent getting a kid some food in his belly so that he can actually concentrate on a lesson, that's a dollar that's not going to teaching him algebra. And you know, when the Act 46 representatives come around with their show telling how great it is, they don't want to hear about this. They say, oh, mental health, if you look at the budgets, mental health isn't really a very big part of the budget, but that is not true. You can, if you looked at the numbers and, you know, the actual numbers going to quote-unquote mental health, maybe that is true. But if you look at the daily workings of a school and you took into account the number of minutes a day that each teacher is spending dealing with students' mental, physical, and home life health issues instead of teaching, you would be shocked and astonished, and you realize the schools are being asked to do the jobs of three or four agencies now. They're not simply being asked to educate, and it's unfair to criticize schools for spending too much money when you're asking them to do more and more.
Okay, Dan, we appreciate your phone call. Senator Cummings?
Okay, we have heard that, and we understand that. Poverty combined with the opiate addiction in this state, other forms of addiction, are having a major impact on schools, and they are requiring that schools do much, much more than just educate children. And so we understand that. We actually have sent out a group, and they are due to bring their report back to us, if not next week, the week after, about how we can, you know, work better. Why do schools have to hire social workers when the state has social workers? Why should this have to happen? How can we, in the most efficient manner possible, provide education, have children ready to learn? And I think that's one reason that the Senate is less enthused about just a threshold, because all you need is one or two of those high-need students to move in, and it can throw a school's budget. That's also the next thing we hope to look at this year, if we can ever get beyond thresholds, is to look at the whole cost of special education, how we're delivering it, is it working, what are the best models, because that is another major driver in the increased cost of education.
Representative Sharp, we got this email from the West Windsor School Board saying they're strongly against the implementation of the spending cap. The town of West Windsor faces a 1% cap on our small school this year, with an increase of $200,000 in special ed, an increase of 7.1% in teacher benefits, $188,000 increase in high school tuitions because they're a choice town, the addition of universal pre-K to this budget. There are not enough dollars remaining in the budget to eliminate to get close to that 1% cap. So their recommendation is let school boards do the work of sifting through Act 46 to achieve the solid goals of the state without punishing taxpayers for taking the time to make the right decisions. Repeal these mandatory spending caps. What would you say to the folks on the school board in West Windsor?
Well, the first thing I would say is they're not mandatory spending caps. They're thresholds where there are tax consequences. The other thing I'd say is let's listen to your first caller who said, you know, we taxpayers are suffering. And for schools to just spend is not an acceptable alternative. Is there middle ground there somewhere? Probably. But let's be realistic. We can't continue to spend the kind of money that we're spending on education and expect our taxpayers not to get extraordinarily upset about what their tax bill is for education.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Greg in Williston. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I just want to call out the gorilla in the room in this whole quality of education versus cost of education. And it's the union contracts that our teachers have with the school supervisory union. What's happening is it's holding on to longer term teachers that have possibly less innovative teaching styles than the newer teachers coming aboard that are delivering higher quality education to our students, that for a fraction of the price of the longer term teachers. That is not the case in all cases. I do understand that, but unions are pretty much a thing of the past. They were beneficial back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, but now in the 21st century, I think we have to move away from unions and let it be a competitive process where teachers are evaluated on a yearly basis, and the most sustainable teachers maintain their jobs, and the others move on. Thank you.
All right, Greg, thanks very much for your phone call. And in addition to that, Senator Cummings, I could be wrong, but I remember some amazing statistic of the aging population of teachers in Vermont, and in the next 5 years or so, a relatively large percentage of teachers are going to end up retiring. Do I have that right?
I believe you do. It's not just teachers, it's our entire workforce. The bulk of our entire workforce, teachers included, are 55 and over. They are going to be retiring, so there will be a big turnover. And maybe in Williston, which is a Chittenden County, you know, school, it's a growing school district, they have young teachers waiting to fill in the slots. That isn't the case in the rest of the state. In fact, there is a federal concern that poorer communities rely on first-year, less experienced teachers, and that study is underway to make sure that minorities and small schools are not being disadvantaged. I think we all realize that you need to have a mix. You need to have some experienced teachers, and you need to have some teachers that have new and innovative training and energy, and that would be the goal. Schools are locally controlled. That is a decision for the local school boards.
I'd like to push back on the caller a little bit. Our teachers, on average, are paid less than any state in the Northeast except Maine, and they're paid less than the national average. So it's not what an individual teacher is getting paid. It's how many staff people we have in our buildings that are the problem. I don't know that the union might be encouraged to play a more active role in reducing the number of staff in our school buildings, but it's not the pay of an individual teacher, which is primarily what the union's responsibility is.
Okay, and we have been told that the number of teachers is going down. There is, schools start to decline in population. You tend to lose one kid in first grade and one kid in third and one in fourth. You have to lose a whole class size before you can eliminate a teacher. We have passed that tipping point, and teachers are being cut back. Where we're seeing an increase is in paraprofessionals, and a lot of that seems to be in the special ed area, where you have children. We have a 30% increase in kids coming into school with severe emotional difficulties. And as the opiate addiction and poverty continue, we don't think we're going to see that slacking off anytime soon. And so the question is, that's not what teachers are trained to do. So how do you find a way to most efficiently deliver the services those students need? And right now, schools, you know, some schools at least seem to be just assigning a paraprofessional to that student. And that may or may not be the best way. But that's where the increase is coming in school personnel.
And Act 46, I would say, came along at just the right time. We do expect a larger than average retiring core in our teaching staff. And it's the perfect opportunity for school districts to figure out better, more efficient ways of delivering education instead of just hiring new staff people to fit those positions where you have a retiring staff person.
Just a little bit of time left, Representative Sharp. I asked Senator Cummings if the idea, if you can't reach a compromise, then this law just stays in place. Is that also an incentive for you as you try to draft a compromise?
Absolutely. I think we've listened to the concerns of school boards and superintendents across the state. And while we feel strongly that cost containment needs to be in place, there is reason to believe that it should be softened.
We'll be following this issue very closely in the next few weeks. Many thanks to our guests today, Senate Education Chairwoman Ann Cummings and House Education Chairman David Sharp. Many thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
Coming up next, I'll talk with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis about why he thinks the campaign of Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is surging in Iowa and New Hampshire. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In 2.5 weeks, voters in Iowa will go to their caucuses to kick off the presidential nomination process. In the last month, the race for the Democratic nomination between Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been tightening up, and some polls now show Sanders in the lead. Why is Sanders surging in Iowa and New Hampshire? And what's the outlook for his campaign after these first two states? With us now to look at the Democratic race is retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Hey, Eric, thanks for being on the program.
Good afternoon, Bob.
So, Eric, we first started talking about the Sanders campaign back in May when he announced he'd be a candidate. At that time, his poll numbers were in single digits. Now it's 8 months later. The latest polls show him in a dead heat with Hillary Clinton in Iowa and ahead in New Hampshire. How did this happen? What has the Sanders campaign done in the last 8 months to be so successful?
Well, Bob, I think it's partly things that Sanders have done, and I think it's also some reservations that voters have about Clinton. In terms of Sanders' campaign, he's been extremely well organized. He has a very large staff of field operatives on the ground in both Iowa and New Hampshire. He's raised a lot of money, almost all of it in small contributions of $100 or less. And he's generated enthusiasm among several important constituencies within the Democratic Party, particularly progressive-minded voters and young voters. At the same time, Secretary Clinton has not been able to overcome some of the doubts that voters have about ethical issues, about transparency issues, which have been raised by the press about her campaign for some time. And also, as a relatively more centrist candidate, she finds it more difficult to generate enthusiasm among the voters than Sanders does. That does not mean, however, that she does not have other advantages. She has more money in the aggregate than Sanders because she's raised a lot of money from larger donors, from super PACs and PACs. And at this point also, Clinton appears better positioned to run a 50-state nationwide nominating campaign than Sanders. One of the big questions I have about Sanders is, assuming he does better than expected in Iowa and New Hampshire, perhaps wins both of them or comes close to winning in Iowa and wins New Hampshire, what does he then do once the primary calendar turns from February into March?
Well, just for a moment, let's consider that possibility. Bernie wins Iowa, and then 8 days later, he wins the New Hampshire primary. How would that development affect the dynamics of this race?
Well, what Sanders has to hope is that those strong showings in the first two states would generate momentum for him in some of the larger states that will be voting in March. I think the last two of the early states, South Carolina and Nevada, are going to be challenging for Senator Sanders because, at least to date, polls show that he is not doing very well among African-American voters who make up a large share of the electorate in South Carolina and not as well among Latino voters who make up a large share of the electorate in Nevada. But on the first day of March, so-called Super Tuesday, there's about a dozen states that vote. One of them is Vermont. But Sanders has to win more than just Vermont on March 1st if he's to be considered a viable national candidate. And there are a number of states that are voting on Super Tuesday, Minnesota, Colorado, Massachusetts, where if Sanders does well in the two early states, he could be well-positioned to pick up a few more victories in early March. And then he has to hope that he can ride momentum from continuing to do well into early March into some of the large industrial states like Michigan and Illinois and Ohio that vote later in March or into April.
So do you think he still faces major challenges in both South Carolina and Nevada?
Yes. I mean, he's been spending more time with more diverse voter groups recently and has been honing his appeal to talk about issues that he didn't talk that much about earlier in the campaign. He is talking more about racial issues. He is talking about reasons beyond class, why diverse voters face challenges in American life and society. Secretary Clinton has a long record of appealing to African-American voters in particular. Latino voters have also been a strong constituency for Clinton. In some of the larger states also, the manufacturing and industrial unions, which continue to be important in those states, are primarily in the Clinton camp.
Now, Eric, these Democratic primaries have proportional voting. So if Bernie Sanders gets 40% of the vote in some state, then he'll end up with roughly 40% of the delegates. In this way, even if he doesn't win a bunch of states on Super Tuesday, he can still collect delegates.
He can still collect delegates as long as he finishes, let's call it a strong second. And I think the percentage you mentioned, 40%, is around that. And based on national polls, I think he's in a good position to get somewhere between 30 and 40% of the delegates in many large states. But again, Hillary Clinton may have a resource available to her that would be enough to put her over on the end. And that's the so-called superdelegates, who are members of Congress, governors, and other party and elected officials. And there are over 700 so-called superdelegates. The number needed to win the nomination is 2,383. So the superdelegates make up close to a third of the number of delegates needed to win the nomination. Now, not all the superdelegates have declared a presidential preference yet, but of those who have, according to the Associated Press, Clinton has a lead over Sanders of more than 300 superdelegates. She has 359 superdelegates in her camp, and Sanders has only 8. So unless Sanders can do well enough to convince his colleagues on Capitol Hill, Democratic governors, members of the Democratic National Committee, other so-called superdelegates, that he has a legitimate chance of winning the nomination and then winning the presidency, Hillary Clinton could still be nominated even if Sanders gets 30 to 40% of the vote consistently through the end of the primaries in early June.
Well, Eric, the Clinton campaign has been saying for months that Hillary Clinton would be the strongest Democratic candidate in the general election. But recent polls seem to indicate that this is not true. Sanders does better than Clinton against Donald Trump or Ted Cruz. Does that surprise you?
Yes and no. I mean, Sanders clearly has a larger appeal in the general election than many analysts would have thought when he first became a candidate. I think one of the concerns here is, A, that there are these issues regarding ethics and transparency around Hillary Clinton that aren't going away. Sanders doesn't talk about them, but the press certainly talks about them, and voters may have those reservations. And the second is, particularly if Trump or Cruz ends up as the Republican nominee, those are rather unconventional candidates, and they appeal to certain voting constituencies that may have been traditionally Democratic in the past. And, you know, that's going to be very interesting to see how that dynamic plays out if one of those two ends up being the Republican nominee, particularly Trump, I believe, who, at least according to everything we've seen so far, both polls and news reports, does have a strong appeal among white working class voters, many of whom have not turned out in large numbers in previous election cycles. That's a group that Sanders talks about a lot in his message, and a well-honed message from Sanders could appeal to the white working class. Hasn't so far in the primaries, but that's not to say that Sanders couldn't develop an appeal to those voters by the time of the general election.
Eric, you've been following politics very closely for a number of years. Have you ever seen a year like this one?
No, this is by far the most unpredictable election cycle I've seen, and I've been following presidential campaigns professionally for about 40 years now. And I think myself and other analysts need to be very careful in terms of making projections about this year's election cycle, because the conventional wisdom and the accepted analysis of political science and political practitioners that have been developed over the years, it seems increasingly less likely to apply in this particular cycle. There's levels of discontent and anger and dissatisfaction among the electorate that we've not seen for a very, very long time, as well as a marked disjunction between the views of political elites and the views of grassroots voters in both political parties.
I mean, is that basically what you think is going on, that you have a lot of voters who are very angry and very unhappy with the status quo?
Yes, and those voters don't like to be told what to do by party leaders, by the media, and other so-called elites. And in that respect, I think there's a similarity between what's going on the Republican side and in the Democratic side.
Eric, it'll be fascinating to see how this story unfolds in the coming weeks. VPR is sending a team to Iowa next weekend to get a sense of what's happening on the ground in that state. Former Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
That's our program for today. In his State of the State address, Governor Peter Shumlin again called attention to the opiate abuse situation in Vermont. He wants to see a tight limit placed on the amount of pain medication that can be dispensed. Monday on the program, we'll take a close look at the connection between pain management and opiate abuse. Send your questions or comments about solutions to combat the opiate crisis to VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.